massive amounts of money, money that they do not have, to make his proposed changes. Schwab says elsewhere in the article that this will, quote, require stronger and more effective governments, end quote, 282. Expanding social programs. In a variety of articles, speeches, presentations, interviews, and videos, Great Reset supporters have made it abundantly clear that their plan for building a more equitable society requires large government-funded socialist or progressive programs, which would be paid for by increasing taxes on the wealthy and businesses, as well as through the printing of money by central banks like the Federal Reserve in the United States. Geeta Gopinath, the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, said during an interview with WEF promoting the Great Reset, quote, I believe it's very important for countries to recognize that there are essential services that need to be provided in terms of healthcare, education, good governance, and a social safety net that cannot be compromised on, end quote. Sharon Burrow, the general secretary of the International Trade Union Conference, also supports the Great Reset. During a similar interview, Burrow said, I can see how we both use this opportunity to design a better world, but we need both national and multilateral institutions to make it work, end quote. Later, Burrow added, quote, we must ensure this design is inclusive of universal social protection. The world could fund it right now, and yet 70% of the world's population has no social protection. It must be respectful of public services rather than simply trying to profit from them, end quote. Here, Burrow is not clear by what she means by universal social protection, which is not a term you often hear in the United States. However, on the website of the International Trade Union Confederation, which claims to represent 200 million workers in 163 countries, the organization spells out in detail what she's referring to. In a June 2020 campaign brief titled, The Global Social Protection Fund is Possible, the ITUC writes, quote, the COVID-19 pandemic has brutally exposed the fault lines of global divide between those who have universal social protection, including health and income support, and those that do not. ITUC later explains, social protection is essential for human security and social justice. It is a foundation for peaceful societies committed to building shared prosperity. It creates the basis for economic development and builds resilience against personal, national, or global shocks. A social protection floor includes basic income security, including cash transfers where necessary, pensions for the elderly, disability benefits, unemployment benefits and support, maternity protection, and child benefits, among other nationally identified needs. In addition, and equally important, she continues, universal access to essential social services, including health, education, water, sanitation, and housing, is vital, 287. Providing the entire world's population with a litany of government-funded social programs? I mean, I'd love to see the price tag on that one. No doubt it would make the $94 trillion Green New Deal in America look like an off-brand can of tomatoes on the discount shelf at Dollar General. The stated purpose of the Great Reset's proposed expansion of government, social protection, is to promote left-wing goals. Kristalina Georgieva, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, said in a June 2020 address about the Great Reset that any economic recovery must focus on fairer growth, end quote. Quote, we know that if left to its own devices, this pandemic is going to deepen inequality. That has happened in prior pandemics, and we can avoid this if we concentrate on investing in people, in the social fabric of our societies, in access to opportunities, in education for all, in the expansion of social programs, so we take care of the most vulnerable people. Georgieva added, then we can have a world that is better for everyone, end quote. In the same talk, Georgieva then explained that the creation of the government-run healthcare system in the United Kingdom following World War II serves as an important, quote, example from the past of how governments can use crises to enact progressive reforms. Quote, I want to conclude with an example from the past, she said. William Beveridge. In the midst of the Second World War, he put forward his famous report in 1942, in which he projected how the UK should address what he called the five giant evils. That famous Beveridge report led to a better country after the war, including the creation of the National Health Service that is saving so many lives today in the UK. Now, of course, Gorgieva left out how the National Health Service has for decades been poorly managed, underfunded, and associated with rationing and long wait times. According to the New York Times, a publication that often promotes left-wing causes like single-payer healthcare, quote, denying life-saving care to conserve public resources is nothing new for Britain's National Health Service, end quote. Quote, in expensive treatments for cancer and other diseases, the health service officially limits what it will spend to postpone a death. £30,000, or about $37,000, for each year of full quality of life provided to a patient. That's according to the New York Times. In case you were ever wondering how much you mean to the government, the United Kingdom's bureaucrats went through the trouble of assigning specific value to your life. How thoughtful of them. Wow, this year's worth $37,000. In addition to calls for expanding universal social protection through government-run or government-managed healthcare and education programs, individual Great Resetters and others aligned with the World Economic Forum have also demanded a variety of large government programs that may or may not be part of a final Great Reset platform that could be released in 2022. Guy Standing, a professor in development studies at the University of London and a nominee for the Most Literal Name Ever Award, authored an article in April 2020 for the World Economic Forum titled Coronavirus Has Shown Us Why We Urgently Need to Make a Basic Income a Reality. In the article, Standing argues that in this pandemic, the economy will not survive without a quasi-universal basic income program. Standing is not alone in demanding new basic income programs. In April 2020, the Assistant Secretary General of the United States and the Chief Economist for the Asia-Pacific Group at the UN Development Program argued that the COVID-19 pandemic had made it apparent that it is now time to add a new element to the policy packages that governments are introducing, one we know but one we have abandoned, the Universal Basic Income, UBI. It is needed as part of the package that will help us get out of this yawning pit. 295. It's impossible to say what additional multi-trillion-dollar government social programs will be dreamt up at the World Economic Forum's various Great Reset meetings in the years to come. But based on other parts of the Great Reset platform, I think it's a safe bet to say, at the least, they would expand the power and influence of government bureaucrats and the ruling class. Now, before we move on, I want to once again stress the importance of resisting the urge to view the Great Reset as a socialist or even progressive framework. There are socialist and progressive elements to the plan. I just pointed them out. But we also have already encountered what should be a big red flag throughout this book. I've noted repeatedly that corporations, bankers, and some of the world's wealthiest people have proudly stood behind the Great Reset. Does anybody really believe that these Wall Street cutthroats and billionaire and entrepreneurs have suddenly become card-carrying members of the Democratic Socialists of America? No, of course they haven't. The real reason there are so many corporate and financial industry interests lining up to promote the Great Reset is because of money and power, the true driving force behind the reset. We're going to get into that topic in a lot more detail later in this chapter. But it's important to keep this point in mind as we navigate our way through this complex issue. The progressive and socialist elements to the reset are merely there to win support from some groups on the left while simultaneously expanding the power of elites. The ruling class has not, no matter what they say, had a real come-to-Bernie moment which probably explains why you typically won't find Sanders at Davos cocktail parties. A Global Green New Deal. As I explained at length in Chapter 3, the most important long-term justification used by supporters of the Great Reset is that it is necessary for saving humanity from the existential crisis posed by climate change. In that chapter, I noted that Schwab has argued, we only have one planet, and we know that climate change could be the next global disaster with even more dramatic consequences for humankind. We have to decarbonize the economy in the short window still remaining and bring our thinking and behavior once more into harmony with nature, end quote. So, how exactly do Klaus and friends aim to bring Americans into harmony with nature? Well, by imposing an expansive, never-before-attempted global Green New Deal that would wipe out the use of most fossil fuels and replace conventional energy with wind, solar, and other earth-destroying green energy sources. Martina Larkin, she's a member of the Executive Committee at the World Economic Forum. She wrote in May 2020 that the Green Deal must be at the heart of the COVID-19 recovery in Europe. According to Larkin, the new forecast by climate experts at the Global Carbon Project predicts that carbon dioxide emissions could fall by the largest amount since the Second World War due to the impact of COVID-19 on economic activity. This means the carbon output could fall by more than 5% year over year, which is the first dip since a 1.4% reduction following the 2008 financial crisis. However, as economic activity resumes and countries and companies develop recovery strategies, quote, we need to fast track the structural changes towards a fossil-free economy. The European Green Deal could be the opportunity to leapfrog in this ambition. Achieving this transformative agenda and making Europe a leader in global climate transition requires a massive mobilization of public and private investments. The Commission estimates that reaching the net zero 2050 target requires at least 1 trillion euros of public and private investment over the next decade. However, as Larkin knows well, most European nations, just like the United States, do not have any cash available for all public and private investment needed to build literally billions of solar panels. They're running huge deficits. How do they plan to pay for the Green New Deal? Now you know, print the money, in line with the principles of Stephanie Kelton and other modern monetary theorists. There is simply no feasible way to pay for plans this ambitious without a monetary framework that would allow for absurdly high levels of government deficit spending. Larkin and Schwab are not the only Great Reset supporters who have called for massive green infrastructure plans as part of COVID-19 recovery. Just about everyone I could find that supports the Great Reset also backs some version of the Green New Deal, both in Europe and elsewhere. And many have begun attempting to link the pandemic to green infrastructure proposals in the earliest days of the coronavirus crisis. In March 2020, the World Economic Forum published an article titled, Could COVID-19 Give Rise to a Greener Global Future? An article was written by two academics and the co-president of the Club of Rome, a powerful nonprofit organization most famous for its 1972 book, The Limits to Growth, which predicted that modern civilization may not survive the 21st century because all of our resources are going to be depleted. According to the authors of the March article, the only way to save the planet is to use the COVID-19 pandemic to rebuild the global economy using policies such as the Green New Deal. Here's what they wrote, quote, the coronavirus pandemic is a wake-up call to stop exceeding the planet's limits. After all, deforestation, biodiversity loss, and climate change all make pandemics more likely. Governments that succeed in containing epidemics all tactically follow the same mantra, follow the science and prepare for the future. But we can do much better. Rather than simply reacting to disasters, we can use the science to design economies that will mitigate the threats of climate change and biodiversity loss and pandemics. We must start investing in what matters by laying the foundation for a green, circular economy that is anchored in nature-based solutions and geared toward the public good, end quote. They then called on lawmakers to redirect public funding linked to fossil fuels toward green infrastructure, reforestation, and investments in a more circular, shared, regenerative, low-carbon economy. At the 2020 World Economic Forum virtual meeting, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, said the Great Reset should be used to build economies that are more sustainable, a term often used by great resetters as a stand-in for green energy. Guterres also called for economies to become more resilient in the face of climate change and many other global changes we face, end quote. What Larkin, Guterres, and Schwab don't mention, however, is that the financial institutions, the investors and corporations, would amass untold trillions of dollars if the Green New Deal were to become reality and spread globally. More on that a little later. Global cooperation. If you're wondering how all of this can be achieved on a grand scale without increasing the power of global governing bodies like the United Nations, then you're not alone. Although great resetters never say they want to abandon all notions of national sovereignty in favor of world government, they do make it clear that greatly empowering international organizations like the United Nations will be necessary under a Great Reset model. Schwab admits that the level of cooperation and ambition this Great Reset implies is unprecedented. But he says, quote, "It's not some impossible dream. It simply will require global cooperation on a gigantic scale." Quote, "This global pandemic has also demonstrated again how interconnected we are," Schwab said. "We have to restore a functioning system of smart global cooperation structured to address the challenges of the next 50 years. The Great Reset will require us to integrate all stakeholders of global society into a community of common interest, purpose, and action." Now, I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist again, but a global community of common interest, purpose, and action sounds an awful lot like Schwab is suggesting we put international governing bodies in charge of the world economy, doesn't it? Fike Sibesma is a member of the Board of Trustees at the World Economic Forum and co-chair for the Global Center on Adaptation. He's a little clearer about the Great Reset's intention to usher in a glorious new era of enhancing global government, or at the very least, a high degree of global cooperation that would change societies around the world. According to him, the Great Reset requires improving global multilateral cooperation and aligning both the recovery of our economies and priorities of societies. For the Great Reset to succeed, we have to change the way we do business and manage health, nature, the environment, and societal issues at the same time. Despite the unprecedented impact and global spread, there was little cooperation between countries. In many aspects, it was everyone from themselves when buying ventilators, face masks, tests, and more. As healthcare for government is a domestic issue, countries did not explore multilateral joint approaches and solutions. Let's hope this was not the litmus test for other cross-border crises like climate change. Only via collaboration between countries can we address such issues, end quote. The stakeholder economy. Now, it's easy to look at the long list of left-wing government programs appearing earlier in the chapter and think that this is all about resetters and what they have in mind when they talk about pushing the Great Reset button on the global economy. But the truth is, as crazy as it might sound, the trillions of dollars in new spending, total destruction of the world's existing energy industry, and a creation of countless social programs like universal basic income and government-managed health care are not the most important parts of the reset or even part of the foundation of the plan. At the beginning of this chapter, I cited Klaus Schwab's broad outline for the Great Reset. And at the time, I told you his call is to steer the market towards fairer outcomes by, in part, creating the conditions for a stakeholder economy. This was something I told you you should take note of because it plays a pivotal role in grasping just how big the Great Reset transformation would be. So now that you have a better understanding of some of the more overtly socialistic elements of the Great Reset, let's turn our attention to what Schwab and many others in the Great Reset movement mean by building a stakeholder economy. At first, the idea of a stakeholder economy is also commonly referred to as stakeholder capitalism. Sounds innocuous, right? I mean, even a little bit boring. After all, the idea of government and business officials caring about stakeholders, a term that normally means one who is involved in or affected by a course of action, does not sound very radical. But if you actually start to dig deeper into the Great Reset pit, you will quickly see that stakeholder capitalism represents a dramatic departure from our common understanding of market-based economies. Stakeholder capitalism is an economic system in which the companies are effectively required to put social justice causes and/or the goals of elites, which of course vary wildly depending on parties involved, before profits, before supply, before demand, before the desires of consumers and other market forces that normally direct capitalistic systems, which, don't forget, have created the most prosperous, healthy, safe societies humankind has ever known. Our more traditional understanding of capitalism is also called shareholder capitalism by Great Resetters, because they say it prioritizes the interest of the shareholders, another word for owners of the corporation, over the interest of the wider community. After calling for a change in capitalism, Fike Shebesma explained in an article for the World Economic Forum that under the Great Reset, the economic focus should shift from short-term and profit only to longer-term, incorporating value creation for people and the planet. So moving from shareholder value to stakeholder interests, end quote, 308. Schwab, who had long advocated for stakeholder capitalism, said in January 2020, business now has to fully embrace stakeholder capitalism, which means not only maximizing profits, but use their capability and resources in cooperation with the government and civil society to address the key issues of this decade. They have to actively contribute to a more cohesive and sustainable world. Shebesma further explained that the principles that must be embraced by companies in a stakeholder capitalist system focus on a longer-term economic strategy that is anchored in addressing the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, produced by the United Nations. When Great Resetters talk about shifting to a stakeholder model, they typically mean one centered on UN SDGs. So it's important to understand what the Sustainable Development Goals involve and why the Great Reset promoters are so interested in them. The Sustainable Development Goals were created at a meeting of the United Nations in September 2015. The SDGs, which serve as a successor to the United Nations Agenda 21 Sustainable Development Plan, yes, that Agenda 21, represent commitments made by UN nations to end poverty and hunger everywhere, to combat the inequalities within and among countries, to build peaceful, just, and inclusive societies, to protect human rights and promote gender equality and the empowerment of women and girls, and to ensure the lasting protection of the planet and its natural resources. That's a quote. And they want to do it all by 2030. Footnote 311. If you ever hear anyone talk about Agenda 2030, it is almost certainly in reference to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. By the way, go look at your local town zoning committee. I'm betting you're going to find a lot of, at least the logo of Agenda 2030 on their website. According to the United Nations, this collective journey is, quote, accepted by all countries and is applicable to all, taking into account different national realities, capacities, and levels of development, and respecting national policies and priorities, end quote. In their commitment to the Sustainable Development Goals, member nations say they have imagined a world free of poverty, hunger, disease, and want, where all life can thrive. They also said, "We see a world free of fear and violence, a world with universal literacy, a world with equitable and universal access to quality education at all levels, to health care and social protection where physical, mental, and social well-being are assured, a world where human habitats are safe, resilient, and sustainable, and where there is universal access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy, a world of universal respect for human rights and human dignity, the rule of law, justice, equality, and non-discrimination, of respect for race, ethnicity, and cultural diversity, of equal opportunity, permitting the full realization of human potential and contributing to shared prosperity." They further committed to a world in which every country enjoys sustained, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth and decent work for all. A world in which consumption and production patterns and use of all natural resources from air to land, rivers to lakes, and aquifers to oceans and seas are sustainable. One in which democracy, good governance, and the rule of law, as well as an enabling environment at national and international levels, are essential for sustainable development, including sustained and inclusive economic growth, social development, environmental protection, and the eradication of poverty and hunger. One in which development and the application of technology are climate sensitive, respect biodiversity, and are resilient. One in which humanity lives in harmony with nature, and which wildlife and other living species are protected. Wow. I mean, I understand the desire to aim high, but creating a world full and free of want? I mean, I want a unicorn and clouds made out of cotton candy. Is the United Nations promising any of these things? Fat dads like me love cotton candy clouds, and we demand to know. I realize a lot of this sounds like your standard pie-in-the-sky globalism from the United Nations, and that is because... stop doing this to me. I realize that all of this sounds like your standard pie-in-the-sky globalism from the United Nations, and that's because that is exactly what the Sustainable Development Goals are. But this doesn't mean that they're meaningless. They certainly have a lot of value to supporters of the Great Reset, who want to use these goals as a springboard to control economic activity while making their corporate friends filthy rich. But how exactly does that work? Schwab and other Great Reset supporters want to transform the current global economy into one which every company focuses more on advancing SDGs, or whatever else the ruling class deems important, than profits. In December 2019, Schwab and the World Economic Forum released its Davos Manifesto 2020, which outlines some of the core values of a new stakeholder economy. In a stakeholder economy, the manifesto notes, quote, "The purpose of a company is to engage all of its stakeholders in shared and sustainable value creation. In creating such value, a company serves not only its shareholders, but all of its stakeholders, employees, customers, suppliers, local communities, and society at large," 316. Now, let me put this in much clearer terms. In a stakeholder capitalist system, companies should first serve the collective according to the demands of the ruling class in government, not the customers, not the owners. Stakeholder capitalism is just another way of saying collectivist capitalism, which is not capitalism in any way. To many Americans, perhaps even some reading this book, the concept might not sound all that worrisome. You might be thinking, okay, so under the Great Reset, companies would have to factor in other considerations in addition to profits. So what? I get it. I do. That's why this is so sexy. Before dismissing my concerns, I want you to stop and think for a minute about the implications of this idea. A profit-driven model for business ensures that companies put the consumer first. Under this system, individuals dictate the products and the services that are produced by voting with their dollars. Companies that want to survive listen to the demands of their customers and even try to anticipate them. But in a stakeholder system, individuals are replaced by an elite group of Bond villain wannabes in the ruling class. They dictate which products and services are produced and who ought to be hired to provide them to customers. Not you, not the individual. Understanding ESG. How can the Great Reset overlords know which companies are properly pursuing the right goals? Well, to help push business in the direction the elites in society deem best, the World Economic Forum, business leaders, financial institutions, activists, and government officials from all around the world have developed environmental, social, and governance, ESG, metrics. They can help companies, investors, governments, and the public know who the good businesses are and which scoundrel companies are interested only in turning a profit, developing new products, hiring more employees. Now, there is nothing worse than a company looking to hire more employees and earn a profit in the marketplace, right? Although there are several versions of this ESG metrics that are available today, the metrics promoted by the World Economic Forum and the International Business Council, a group created by the WEF in 2001, are perhaps positioned best to become the international standard in the coming years. The final draft of the WEF metrics, titled Measuring Stakeholder Capitalism Toward Common Metrics and Consistent Reporting of Sustainable Value Creation, was released in September 2020. It was prepared in collaboration with experts from the Bank of America and the Big Four accounting firms, Deloitte, KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and Ernst & Young, all of which worth tens of billions of dollars and widely considered to be the most influential and powerful firms in the world. You know, real down-to-earth people who know what life is like for the average everyday worker. The World Economic Forum's ESG standards include 21 core metrics and 34 expanded metrics. Together, they allow auditors to develop a comprehensive ESG score that can be used to determine whether a company is in line with the demands of the ruling class. Footnote 318. The standards are divided into four pillars: principles of governance, planet, people, and prosperity. Although some of the core metrics that compose each pillar are reasonable and even advisable, like closely tracking incidents of corruption confirmed during the current year but related to previous years, many others are clearly designed to advance social justice causes favored mostly by those on the left. In the principles of governance pillar, WEF suggests that companies be scored based on the membership of underrepresented social groups serving in a company's governing body, as well as those leaders' competencies relating to economic, environmental, and social topics. Let me just make a side note here. So you're underrepresented in Silicon Valley if you're a conservative. So you would say ESG would demand that you are up unrepresented, you should be on the board of directors. Not so fast. You also have to have competency relating to economic, environmental, and social topics. You see how you can quickly be boxed out? In the planet pillar, companies are evaluated based on their greenhouse gas emissions and their compliance with the Paris Climate Accords, their land use and ecological sensitivity, and their water consumption and withdrawal in water-stressed areas, among other environmental standards. The people pillar is full of woke ideology, including an ESG measure for the percentage of employees per employee category by age group, gender, and other indicators of diversity, e.g. ethnicity, as well as pro-labor union members, such as the percentage of active workforce covered under collective bargaining agreements. So now let's stop and think about that. What is the World Economic Forum's ESG model? What would it really look like in the real world? Well, under WEF standards, a company with a relatively large profit high employee and customer satisfaction and high quality products and services, a company that would be universally considered well-managed under a free market system could actually be rated lower than a company in the same industry that is less efficient, has fewer profits, worse products and services, but has the ratio of Asian to black workers, low carbon dioxide emissions in their supply chain, and the ideal number of transgender members on the board of directors. Now, let's get one thing right out from the very start. Private businesses should have the right to engage in any number of silly, stupid, wasteful, noble, kind, compassionate, or ridiculous causes, or to hold themselves to standards that I think are foolish or counterproductive. As far as I'm concerned, if a business wants to create an ESG system that rewards corporations that give raises only to workers who like the color green or pay salaries ending in odd numbers or are owned by people named Glenn, I'm fine with that. Investors, employees, and consumers should have the right to decide who they want to do business with. And if people want to spend their time and money doing business with only the wokest of the woke companies, then that should be their right. But for the most part, that system has existed in every market economy. Nothing has stopped consumers from buying from only those companies that choose to embrace their ideals. And nothing has stopped investors from investing in those companies. So what do Klaus Schwab and the other Great Reset elites have in mind when they say they want to advance the ESG model, tear down the existing shareholder capitalist system, and replace it with an economy focused on stakeholders? The answer is almost certainly twofold. The transformation could be brought on by either government mandates or the use of monetary incentives made possible by newly printed cash from central banks. Under the first option, governments around the world could start building stricter regulatory schemes that directly or indirectly force businesses to focus on improving ESG scores rather than profits in order to continue operating in certain nations or regions or to continue being publicly traded corporations. Some governments have already started putting into place regulations that force companies to act responsibly in line with the concerns of the elites. As the World Economic Forum project specialist Elizabeth Anvig noted in a May 2020 WEF article calling for the Great Reset, quote, "Legal and societal pressures on businesses operating around the world are rapidly evolving. There is a call for efforts to better align the activities of corporations with society's drive to build a more inclusive, equitable, and sustainable economy. The implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, and Agenda 2030 will depend on positive contributions from the private sector through responsible business conduct and responsible investments. Doing the right thing is about more than just complying with the law. However, legal obligations are increasingly requiring companies to act responsibly," 321. In some cases, American investors and businesses themselves are begging for regulatory agencies to use their power to impose social justice and environmental causes. In July 2020, a group of more than three dozen large investors, activists, nonprofits, pension funds, and former politicians, which together manage nearly $1 trillion in assets, sent a letter to the Federal Reserve, that's America's central bank, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and other regulatory bodies, asking them to impose rules that would supposedly help stop climate change. According to the New York Times, the letter read in part, quote, "The climate crisis poses a systemic threat to financial markets and the real economy, with significant disruptive consequences on asset valuations and on our nation's economic stability." The Times further reported, quote, "That financial threat, combined with the physical risks posed by climate change, may create disastrous impacts, the likes of which we have never seen before," the letter says. It urges the Fed, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and other agencies, quote, to explicitly integrate climate change across your mandates, end quote. These investors are asking the U.S. government to do everything in its power to force other companies to adopt their woke causes, bringing to mind the old statist slogan, ideas so good, they're mandatory, end quote. Similarly, according to the World Economic Forum, Ma Jun, the chairman of the China Green Finance Committee and an avid supporter of the Great Reset, has called for the reset to include, quote, tighter reporting and regulation for companies, end quote, to ensure they are working harder to advance environmental goals. Regulatory agencies in the United States are listening. In March 2021, Perkins Coie, a highly influential international law firm, reported, quote, over the past few weeks, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has taken several actions that put climate change front and center, reflecting the importance to many investors of climate change-related disclosures. In early February, the SEC announced the addition of Satyam Khanna as a senior policy advisor charged with coordinating and overseeing efforts related to climate and other environmental, social, and governance issues. Mr. Khanna is the first ever senior policy advisor for ESG issues at the SEC. Since then, the SEC has announced a rapid series of additional initiatives. President Biden's nominee to be the next SEC chair, Gary Gensler, said during his confirmation hearing that investors want more information about climate risks and that disclosure requirements should be grounded in what reasonable investors find material. If confirmed, Mr. Gensler indicated to the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs that he would likely pursue rulemaking around climate risk disclosures and perhaps other ESG topics. 325. Side note, between the printing of this book and the recording of this session, he is now serving officially as the chair of the SEC. Additionally, in August 2021, Bloomberg writer Bill Dudley outlined some of the radical developments underway at the U.S. Federal Reserve, led by Chair Jay Powell, who is eagerly working to build a regulatory framework that can be used to push banks and companies they do business with to adopt climate and energy policies favored by the left. Powell and the Fed Board of Governors created two new entities, the Financial Stability Climate Committee, to focus on the broader financial system, and the Supervision Climate Committee to focus on individual institutions. Now, this matters because it means top officials are committed to regularly evaluating and responding to the threat of climate change. They've already been working to ensure that banks embed climate change in all of their business decisions, analyzing exposures, identifying concentrations of risk, and considering how to manage them over time. 326. The recent developments at the SEC and Federal Reserve are vital because they will serve as the foundation for future Great Reset economic transformations in the United States by providing lawmakers in Washington with all of the tools that are needed to push companies towards full ESG adoption. And they are already acting as a warning to American businesses that future regulatory changes are just around the corner. But as troubling as things are in America, the situation is much worse in Europe, where many political figures have been working for years to make ESG standards mandatory for all large businesses and many small businesses. As my co-author Justin Haskins reported in June 2021, in March, the Parliament of the European Union passed a resolution that seeks to require nearly all of the EU's largest companies and many small businesses, too, to adopt and prioritize ESG metrics. And especially important for U.S. business and consumers, the resolution would further require that EU companies only work with those who share the European Union's environmental, social, and governance standards, end quote. In a report about the European ESG resolution, international law firm Shearman & Sterling noted, quote, if adopted, all EU member states will be required to implement the directive into their national laws. This will result in substantive due diligence requirements being imposed on companies, whether they're based in the EU or selling their product and services to the EU across the entire value chain, with potential sanctions for non-compliance, end quote. Okay, so understanding what the European officials mean by value chain is really important. In their resolution, value chain is defined as all activities, operations, business relationships, and investment chains of an undertaking and includes entities with which the undertaking has a direct or indirect business relationship, upstream and downstream, and which either A, supplies products, parts of products, or services that contribute to the undertaking's own products or services, or B, receive products or services from the undertaking, end quote. 329. That means if the EU resolution were to become law, and at the time of this writing, it is looking more and more likely, all U.S. businesses having any direct or indirect relationship with an EU business, upstream or downstream, would be forced to operate under some or all of Europe's proposed ESG system. Now, it's not true that all great resetters are calling for the use of regulations to impose ESG standards on private companies, at least not in every situation. In some cases, they talk about adopting ESG voluntarily. In 2019, Schwab encouraged businesses to adopt stakeholder capitalist principles voluntarily so that they can move beyond their legal obligations and uphold their duty to society. 331. This is where the second method for creating a stakeholder economic system comes into play. Rather than use regulations to impose environmental, social, and governance standards on companies, some great resetters just want to use massive government and central bank spending programs to push companies towards adopting ESG standards, a move that looks eerily similar to proposals backed by people like modern monetary theorist Stephanie Kelton, who has long suggested that the best way to progress society is to not only expand the power of government, but also print trillions of dollars and tie social justice strings to the money. Pursuing modern monetary theory principles like those supported by Kelton would make it unnecessary to completely dismantle private property ownership. Government and central banks would become the biggest and most important consumers in the marketplace, which, of course, would not and could not function as true markets because of the outsized power and influence of government and central bank spending programs. Chapter 5, continued. Aligning incentives. Say, for example, government funding makes up 20% of a business's income, directly or indirectly. On many issues, that business is going to be far more interested in keeping the government happy than focused on pleasing the individual consumers. And this perversion would only get worse as the government raises its level of involvement. Eventually, individual consumers would become nothing more than an afterthought. As I mentioned before at the start of this chapter, this strategy was clearly stated in Klaus Schwab's article outlining his main components of the Great Reset, published in June 2020. The second component of the Great Reset agenda, he says, quote, would ensure that investments advance shared goals such as equality and sustainability, rather than using these funds as well as investments from private entities and pension funds to fill the cracks in the old system, we should use them to create a new one that is more resilient, equitable, and sustainable in the long run. This means, for example, building green urban infrastructure and creating incentives for industries to improve their track record on environmental, social, and governance metrics. Another, much less misleading word for the incentives Klaus speaks about here is coercion. And if enough money is tied to ESG metrics, that coercion could effectively become necessary to businesses in order for them to survive, especially if it is coupled with the all-new taxes and regulations Schwab and other great resetters also support. Additionally, it is important to note that the great resetters do not always use the words environmental, social, and governance metrics. When they're referring to building their new stakeholder economy, they might use terms like sustainable investment and realigning incentives to convey the same radical idea. Writing for WEF and Project Syndicate in July 2020, Tallulah Oney, a physician and researcher at the University of Cambridge, said, quote, although several global philanthropic initiatives have sought to improve urban health and resilience, undoubtedly with positive results, today's flawed systems need more fundamental disruption. Simply put, the world needs a new Marshall Plan for planetary health, akin to a New Deal for a post-pandemic recovery. According to Oney, this new Marshall Plan would serve as a global guide aligning incentives and shifting default behaviors toward the shared goal of sustainable, healthy urban development. It will require the agreement and participation of national and local governments, private developers, investors, and multilateral organizations, which will take time. Aligning incentives and shifting default behaviors is another way of saying bribing businesses to do what we think is in the best interest of the collective or in line with ESG goals. This is exactly what Great Reset supporter Sharon Burrow, the General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation, had in mind when she said during an interview about the Great Reset, we need to design policies to align with investment in people and the environment. But above all, the longer-term perspective is about rebalancing economies, end quote. Now, she elaborated further in the interview saying, quote, we want an end to the profit-at-all-cost mentality, because if we don't build an economic future within a sustainable framework in which we are respectful of our planetary boundaries, the need to change our energy and technology systems, then we will not have a living planet for human beings, end quote. This is the same sort of thinking used by the French government in 2020 when crafting COVID-19 relief packages for airlines suffering under government lockdowns. As reported by The Guardian in April 2020, quote, some governments are seeking to attach strings to rescue plans. France's Minister for Ecological Transition, Elizabeth Borne, insisted Air France was not getting a blank check. The government had set ecological commitments, she said, including a 50% reduction in carbon emissions on domestic flights by 2024, as well as investing in more fuel-efficient planes, end quote. Many financial institutions have already laid the groundwork for punishing companies that will not go along with the Great Reset mandates. In February 2021, Bank of America, citing its, quote, long-standing support for the Paris Climate Agreement, issued a press release announcing that it had, quote, outlined initial steps to achieve its goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions in all of its financing activities, operations, and supply chain before 2050, end quote. The press release further noted, Bank of America continues to actively engage with its clients to help accelerate their own transitions to net zero, and it plans to establish interim science-based emission targets for high-emitting portfolios, including energy and power. In addition, Bank of America released its broader 2030 operational and supply chain goals as part of a holistic commitment to environmental sustainability, end quote. Notice that Bank of America's goal of net zero greenhouse gas GHG emissions applies not only to the company's operations and supply chain, which means that everyone who does business with Bank of America would have to go along with its goals in order to keep Bank of America as a customer, but also to the bank's financing activities, which is another way of saying, if you don't go green, we're not going to give your business a loan. In the same press release, Bank of America also touted the close relationship its CEO Brian Moynihan has with the World Economic Forum and its involvement with the development of WEF's ESG metrics. And then it included this creepy quote from Bank of America vice chairman Anne Finucane, who, according to the press release, leads the company's environmental, social, and governance, sustainable finance, capital deployment, and public policy efforts. Quote, "It is critical that we leverage all parts of our business beyond our direct operations in order to accelerate the transition to a net zero global economy. We recognize that this will be no easy task, but we believe our commitment will help spur the growth of zero carbon energy and power solutions, sustainable transportation and agriculture, and other sector transformations, while generating more climate resilient and equitable opportunities for our future." Wow. That sounds awfully similar to the exact same kind of thing you might hear while attending a Great Reset meeting in Davos. Again, pay special attention to what a Bank of America is saying here. Its plan to leverage all parts of our business beyond our direct operations in order to accelerate the transition to a net zero global economy. In other words, the plan is to push the world towards elite's goals of a global economy that has net zero carbon dioxide emissions, whether the world wants it or not, by using the full weight and power of one of the wealthiest, most influential banks on Earth. Here's where it gets scary. Bank of America is hardly the only private financial institution pushing ESG standards and green energy mandates. In March 2021, Jane Fraser, the CEO of Citi, a bank worth more than $200 billion, published an article on the company's website titled "Citi's Commitment to Net Zero by 2050. In the article, Fraser declared, "The climate crisis is among the top critical challenges facing our global society and economy today, and there is an urgent need for collective action. We believe that global financial institutions like Citi have the opportunity and the responsibility to play a leading role in help driving the transition to net zero global economy and make good on the promise of the Paris Agreement." So how does Fraser envision Citi, quote, helping drive the transition to net zero global economy? Well, after bragging about various actions that Citi has taken to reduce its own carbon footprint and to facilitate financing for low carbon solutions, Fraser wrote, quote, "Our ESG agenda cannot be a separate layer that sits above what we do day to day. Our commitment to closing the gender pay gap, to advancing racial equity, to pioneer the green agenda have demonstrated this is good for business and not at odds with it. And we will continue to be part of the solution to these challenges and enable others to do so as well." Quote, "Net zero means rethinking our business and helping our clients rethink theirs. For banks, what some don't realize is that net zero includes not just our own operations, but also our core business impacts, including the bank's financing activities," end quote. Years in the making. It is not a coincidence that the announcement from Citi's CEO about the bank's commitment to shift forward a model that will eventually limit financing opportunities to a business that fits its ESG framework came within a month of Bank of America issuing a nearly identical promise. Thanks to a swift shove from the government, the world's financial institutions have been moving in this direction now for many years. As Ian Murray, the Vice President for Strategy and Senior Fellow of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, reported back in 2014 for The Blaze, firearms sellers, pawn shops, payday lenders, even porn stars around the nation have recently found their bank accounts canceled despite years of a good relationship with their banks. When pressed, the banks say it's because of heightened regulatory supervision of high-risk industries. This can be traced back to a shadowy Obama administration program launched in 2013 called Operation Choke Point. Operation Choke Point is a Department of Justice-led initiative aimed at choking off the financial oxygen of potential financial fraudsters who use third-party payment processors to process payments. It does this based on a 2011 guidance document from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, otherwise known as the FDIC, on how banks should manage their relationships with TPPPs that deal with industries that might present, quote, a reputational risk to the bank. Until recently, that guidance contained a list of about 30 high-risk industries, including ammunition, drug paraphernalia, pornography, home-based charities, and many others. Once the public found out about Operation Choke Point, the backlash caused the leadership at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation to withdraw its list of high-risk industries. But Murray noted, Operation Choke Point continued, just in a slightly different guise. He explains, the underlying guidance about reputational risk remains unchanged. All the government has done is remove examples of what might constitute such a risk from its websites. As a result, banks now have to judge for themselves what constitutes that sort of reputational risk that could trigger a federal subpoena. Meanwhile, Justice Department attorneys are using their own judgment about reputational risk to serve as a basis for whom to investigate. If today's focus is on payday lenders, who's to say, for example, that pornography will not be the next industry to come under the spotlight? What about a coal company? When so many are now convinced that coal pollutes the planet and the nation should move toward renewable energy. Although Operation Choke Point was eventually disbanded by the Trump administration in 2017, a clear signal had been sent to the banks and other financial institutions. Don't do business with industries disfavored by many in the federal government. Now, around the same time that 195 countries signed the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015, thereby committing to dramatically reduce their carbon dioxide emissions, banks and financial institutions around the world, with Operation Choke Point and other similar policies in mind, began to shift their focus heavily towards concerns over climate change or how they could better position their businesses in a post-Paris Agreement world. It started with the development of the Partnership for Carbon Accounting Financials, PCAF. It began in 2015. The PCAF members, which include commercial banks, development banks, asset owners, managers, insurance companies, etc., collaborate, quote, to develop and implement greenhouse gas accounting in their organizations, end quote, as well as help spur discussions on climate change and the role of the financial institution to facilitate the transition towards a low-carbon society, end quote. PCAF-compliant financial institutions numbered more than 100 as of March 2021 and include some of the largest institutions in America, such as Bank of America, Citi, Morgan Stanley, and TD Bank. Gee, weren't those some of the banks that were meeting at that train station to go duck hunting? Following the signing of the Paris Agreement, banks and financial institutions worked together to further develop and expand rules, regulations, and guidelines to transform their industries, culminating in the formation of 2019 and the UN Principles for Responsible Banking, the first, quoting, ever global sustainability framework for the banking industry. PRB signatories commit to align their business strategy and practice with the Sustainable Development Goals and the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. Or to put more simply, signatories agree to stop financing any business that refused to adopt the elite's climate change mandates. As of September 2020, more than 190 banks had agreed to the principles for responsible banking, and these signatories look after the business of more than 1.6 billion customers worldwide and represent around 40% of all global banking assets, end quote. However, fear of government mandates is not the only thing banks and financial institutions had in mind when they started building their Great Reset ESG frameworks. Perhaps most important of all is the promise of cold, hard cash. The payoff. It is important to understand that the most corrupt and terrifying elements of the Great Reset also help explain why so many business leaders and financial institutions have agreed to promote this movement. Many have gone beyond mere promotion and even helped develop some of its primary components. This includes the presidents and CEOs from Microsoft, Bank of America, MasterCard, British Petroleum, and other highly influential businesses and investment firms. 347. The crony corporatists running these multi-billion dollar companies have seen the writing on the wall. Governments around the world are increasingly pushing for green mandates and sustainable development, as well as restrictions on speech, whether business and their customers like it or not. Plus, central banks are literally printing trillions of dollars that governments are directing toward the causes they favor, including many focused on social justice. So if you're running a business, especially a huge multinational corporation, it would be stupid not to do everything in your power to get your hands on some of that free cash, right? It is also worth noting that many investors and businesses are not waiting around for what they believe to be the inevitable rise of ESG standards and increased government action. Investors in large corporations do not merely plan 12 months into the future. They plan 12 years into the future. Instead of utilizing potentially catastrophic wait-and-see approaches, they are adopting policies now with the hopes that it will put them in the good graces of the money-printing overlords in central banks and governments all across the planet, including the United States. Nowhere has this been made clearer than in the presentations and articles posted to the website of the Principles for Responsible Investment, PRI Group. It's one of the world's most influential advocates for adopting